Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, product owners all over this great big world, including the people listening in Dubai, the UAE. Welcome back to Deliver It. This is your Agile Product Owners Podcast. My name is Corey Bryan, and today I am feeling accomplished. I've done two weekend projects, got stuff done, which makes me feel good. So now I feel like I can do pretty much anything. So I'm taking on some more creative things. You'll see those in the next couple of weeks. And today, I'm very keen on having a guest. My guest today is a fellow product nerd who leads a group of over 20 other product and agile evangelists. He's presented at conferences. He has a great blog and Twitter feed. He's a herder of cats and a fellow Scrubs fan. It's Ant Murphy. Hi, Ant.
Hey. Thanks for having me. Yes, definitely heard cats. They're bugging me in my meetings all morning this morning, actually.
And how many cats are you herding?
I got two. And the cat herding thing is a funny thing, too, because not only have I used it to describe the role of like product ownership and product management before, and I own cats, I even actually used it in a conference talk once. So
very cool. Very cool. And I love reading Ant's blog post. It's kind of where I got introduced to him and started following him on Twitter. And that's really where an idea for this show came about, which we'll get to our main topic in just a little bit. So the first article that I read is a republish of an older one. There's been a lot of talk recently about Scrum and a lot of things about the history of Scrum and when it came up. And Alistair Cockburn had an article republished on How I Saved Agile and the Rest of the World. And it's a good retrospective about all the 17 people that were there in Snowbird. It was a good explanation about the different backgrounds that we're coming together to talk about that. And really the manifesto that we all reference is a product of those different backgrounds and those methods. Or I like it as a way to go back and say, okay, what was really happening at the time? Why did this garner so much attention or garner so much interest from these different people that had their own kind of methodologies they were pushing? There was Scrum, there was XP, there was Crystal, there was all kinds of different methodologies. And it's just a way to kind of go through and remind ourselves that these were people involved in this, and that sometimes they came at this from their own angle. And if somebody tries to claim credit for it or something else, it helps to go back and look at that story. And it's a story that I had seen a couple times, but this was a good reminder of really that afternoon in Snowbird.
Yeah, definitely. For me, I like the human aspect and the fact that I they didn't even agree on everything as well. And it's that just, it's coming together, varying background, and they come up with something. And sometimes it gets lost too. I think that's kind of the whole point, and you're kind of getting to that just then. It almost gets over-idolized, and it was just a bunch of people trying to get together and agree on some things from different backgrounds. And we should remember that. Maybe an element of everything's imperfectly perfect, maybe.
Yeah, it's the best they could do at the time. And I think that they all acknowledge that, and I think they to get agreement. And I don't even think they went there with the impression of writing a manifesto. I think that was kind of an ad as the event happened. Mm. So it's a good, I like reading about the history and some of these things. I've gone back and read a lot of older books that, were pre-Agile that kind of led into some of that. So I can see a lot of those things being brought into that meeting. So it's just interesting. It's interesting history, if nothing else.
Yes.
Very cool. And another article I read from Mariana Quiglis, who has a product framework for producty folks, which we are producty folks. Product nerds would have been better, but whatever. I'm not picky. But it's a checklist for product thinking, and she's gone through, and I love me a good acronym. So anytime there's a good acronym that I can latch onto, and this one is Pursuit. And it's kind of an A3 type template, canvas type way to go through and say, these are the types of things that if you're thinking about a product feature or a product capability or problem, really, this is a way to think about it. It's a very lightweight kind of way of thinking about this. Pursuit is problems, users, rationale, solution, which is your hypothesis, the uncertainties you face, which I really like that one, the insight or the data, and then the test metrics. So lots of different ways, and there's lots of these different frameworks floating around, but I like this idea that she has of stating some of these things in front of your hypothesis. Let's start with, I believe this will happen if this changes. But I like the inclusion of the uncertainties in that one. It's not something I see a lot in some of these Canvas type applications.
Yeah, agreed. The uncertainties I really liked as well. A pursuit is just, I mean, you take any framework and you remove the marketing and stuff and it's, you know, 80% odd the same. And there's nothing groundbreaking there. Besides maybe the uncertainties piece, that's a nice addition. But pursuit just easy to remember, I think. I think that's the power of that that I like there. Yeah.
Yeah. And thank God it's not another four quadrant.
2x2 matrix, right?
Example. Yeah. 2x2 matrix, yes. That's what I meant to say. 2x2 matrix. Okay.
No doubt that this magnificent vessel will give excellent value for the dollars she'll be earning.
Let's talk about, so I was reading Twitter one day a couple of weeks ago, and a lot of people were talking about depth of thinking or thinking deep thoughts, not Jack Handy style, but just thinking about problems that we see. And I was really coming around to the idea of, I think that's a good topic. I think it's something we don't do enough of. And about that time, I saw Ant tweet out a picture that he had drawn about the same type of problem. It's kind of a reverse iceberg of there's lots of ways, there's lots of problems that we could explore, but we very rarely go very deep on those problems. There's so much open space that's unsolved that you've got on your diagram, and is also kind of the thinking of how deep do we really go when we're solving a customer problem. Now, we could talk about team problems and everything else, but I really wanted to focus on customer problems and how our applications can help them, how our products can help them. And so that's what I really wanted to talk about with Ant today, because I wanted to explore, you know, some of the reasons why we don't do this, some of the things we can do to get down and deep and explore those things. So I just wanted to talk about that, and I loved your drawing, so it's a great thing to have you here to help talk through some of those concepts.
Yeah, absolutely, and it's funny that you say that too, because that was the rationale that spurred that drawing was, I had a number of, I guess, moments during the week leading up to that drawing and that tweet where I was reflecting on how often we don't go that deep, and how sometimes, and some organizations more so than others, there's this real kind of bias for action and this bias for solutions. And, you know, we talk about that, like feature factories and stuff, and I don't want to get into that, but just the idea that, you know, we walk into a meeting and everyone goes, wow, that was so productive because we all agreed in 15 minutes. But that's one person's opinion. There's probably somebody walking out that meeting going, I have no clue what the hell we just talked about. Somebody else walking out thinking, I have so many questions. Well, maybe they're not walking out of that meeting thinking that, but tomorrow morning they'll wake up and they'll think that, right? There's just this premature convergence that we tend to push towards and almost label it as efficiency or productivity, like, oh, we're so great because we do this so quickly. And, you know, to bring it back to the exploring the customer problem in that space, I also see that sometimes in the overuse of, say, something like the 5-day design sprint. You know, that that is quite, in my experience, I've done a lot of design sprints, it can be very shallow and it's only 5 days. And I've compared that to the grid I've covered in, say, a 6 or an 8 week discovery period where we did go really deep in certain problem spaces. And I can see how companies shy away from that because 6-8 weeks is expensive. Some people, you know, some agileists, some people that, you know, I work with would even say that that's way too long. That's a huge cycle of time. But, you know, when I compare what do we cover in 5 days and what do we learn in 5 days versus the depth of learning that we got out of 6 weeks, agreed that you don't want to spend 6 weeks on every problem space, but there are times where it really warrants that, and being able to go deep and understand it and not just scratch the surface. I think there's value in that. I guess the art part is working out where do I spend more time diving into the problem versus less time, right?
Yeah. It's something that I see this. I mean, I've seen this, and it frustrates me to no end, because I think one of the problems with the reason why we don't go deep into these problems is we really don't understand what they are. We understand what people have told us. We understand what people have said, but we don't, like you're saying, we don't take the time to really get in and say, okay, who has this problem? And are we sure that this is the person? Have we talked to them? Have they given us feedback? Have we done interviews? Have we done exploration with them? You know, what problem do they really have? Not the problem that was described to us, but can we sit with them and watch them work? How much time does that take? And You know, what are they doing about it right now? There's so much pressure on, we think this is the problem, go build something. Or we've come up with the solution to their supposed problem, go build it. But we don't get into understanding what the real problem is. And I think that's the first, for me, that's the first kind of flaw in the thinking.
Yeah, absolutely. And I see that as well. And it's sometimes not even like a, that we don't know what the problem is. We think that we know what the problem is, right? So we've mm-hmm. identified something, mm-hmm. we think that's the problem, and we quickly run, we quickly try and solve it. A mate of mine calls it the squeaky wheel syndrome.
Oh yeah.
Where you just hear this squeaky wheel and you always put an oil on it, but it could be something deeper and systematic and you haven't invested the time to work it out. And all you're doing is trying to fix a squeaky wheel. And you know, time's a big part of it. Sometimes we're crunched on time. We're trying to do too many things, or we're trying to do something else, or we're trying to move on to the next thing. Pressures mm-hmm. within inside of an organization always kind of adds to it. But you know, it also reminds me of that often attributed to Einstein quote. That was something like, if I had an hour to solve a problem, I'd spend 55 minutes oh, yeah. understanding what the problem is, and then 5 minutes on the yeah. solution. Yeah. On solving it, I think he says, yeah.
Yeah, the idea that we would spend a day understanding, is this a buyer problem, is this a seller problem, a user problem, or are they different problems? Odds are they're different problems, especially if you're in a B2B site situation. You know, let's go and pull some data. If we don't have data, what can we do to get data? Every company I've walked into and said, great, let's look at your products and let's see how your products are being used. And I get told to go talk to the customer service representative because that's the person who knows how our products are being used. No, he doesn't. He may think he knows, but he really doesn't. And where's the raw data? Where's the interviews that either the UX people, the product people, or the teams have had with the users to understand these things? And where's the experiments that you're running now? What experiments have you run? Ideally, you're running lots of experiments and lots of them are failing. I would love to walk into an organization or see that, have that conversation of, 70% of our experiments failed. That should be the norm. That should be, of course they fail because you don't know.
Yeah.
And you only find out when you do those types of experiments and you do that. But again, that takes time that some organizations aren't willing to go for. So those types of things really help us understand those problems more. But they do take time. And, I would be okay with doing some of those things for 2 to 6 weeks. We're not going to take a year. We're not going to write a 40-pound document to do that. But let's take some time and let's make sure we understand this, make sure we do the right things that we need to do in order to understand what the real problem is.
Yeah, absolutely. And not only invest in time, I often say it too, like it's like that that 80-20 principle. If we invest more time, yes, we're not building stuff, but if we invest more time in deep problem exploration and understanding, and the multiple problems is a big piece too. That squeaky wheel is probably connected to something else, which is connected to something else. And the more time you can invest into diving into that, you're going to uncover other problems, which are probably very pertinent problems to solve in that squeaky wheel. Some of them are root causes to the squeaky wheel. Some of them are just knock-on effects that you need to also consider inside your design and your solution. But if you spent, say, 2 to 6 weeks exploring the problems, we could save 2 to 6 weeks of build time, or probably more, because it's usually exponential. It's not actually one for one in actual build time of a solution, because we've actually found the problem that we should be solving, as opposed to solving all these banded solutions and all this surface space. And it's like that idea of activity. We like that activity. We like seeing stuff output. But what we're really trying to say is, no, let's chase the outcome and spend more time doing exploration and more time doing discovery and getting data and talking to users and talking to customers and understanding the market. So we build less is really the goal, right? Yeah.
It is. That was reminding me. I was looking through something a couple of days ago, and it was reminding me of a quote from either David Hussman or somebody who said that, your job is not to build software. Your job is to solve problems through product. And we should do that, like you're saying, with the least amount of software that we could build. And so let's do that. I like the notion there of there's a core problem that our products are there to solve with our customers for, right? They come to us for something. It's an app or it's a product. It's a billing application. It's booking flights. God forbid, going into JIRA. It's doing things that our product really needs to do. Understanding what they use our application for, understanding why they're coming to us to solve that problem for them. What is that real core problem? And there's really only one or two core problems they use our applications for, unless it's something like Salesforce or some of these other big enterprise applications where they do lots and lots of things. Most of the time, they're coming to you and your application and your product for one or two really core things. And how well do we understand those? How well do we understand the problems that are connected to that? Because there may be one or two core things, but maybe there's this really important thing they do once a year, or maybe there's this really critical thing they have to do every other week or something like that. And do we understand how that operates as well?
Yeah. And I mean, the whole idea of trying to find, I guess, product market fit and having a solid value proposition is to understand those problems deep enough. If you don't understand those problems deep enough, you can't solve them well enough to have a solid value proposition for people to buy it, right? That's the whole intent. And I mean, you look at the rates of failure for products and startups and like and how much that's attributed to not being able to find product market fit. I mean, a part of me is now thinking, is that a measurement to say that, hey, we aren't actually invested enough time to understand these problem spaces before we go ahead and, you know, create a startup and, you know, quit my job and, you know, chase it. And then suddenly, you know, yeah, no surprise, value prop's not clear, people aren't buying it, don't have product market fit. And that's not to say that you're going to get those things by understanding the problem space beforehand and then you're going to ship and you're just going to nail it straight away. No, but I think it increases your chances. And the more you understand the problem, the more you go deep into that space, the more you get research and all that and talk to people, then you could probably kill the idea off earlier, potentially, is one thing, because you now have low confidence in it. Or you've pivoted as a part of that and then you've got more confidence going to the market, or you go to the market with high confidence, right? And it de-risks is what I'm probably getting at.
One of the things that I've done a couple of times with a couple of different products is I've had the opportunity to not only iterate on them, on that core problem, but come back to it multiple times. So yes, we might do, you know, a release and we might iterate on a core functionality, a core piece of navigation in the application. We might do that. We might do that over two or three sprints and then we'll call that done and then we'll go on to something else. Very few times have I come back, maybe in about another 3 months, back to that initial navigation. Maybe it's the landing page and how do you get from there to the sign in, or how maybe we're changing what is on our landing page when you sign in, because most people want to do action X when they get in. They want to run their report or they want to see their balance on something. So coming back and not only iterating just in a small window, but then coming back 3 months later, 6 months later, a year later, and doing those again, testing those things out, trying those things out, that's very unique. I've not only done that, like I said, two or three times, but really think about the number of things, product owners, that you're iterating on. How often do you experiment or iterating on this? Is it one time? Do you just release it and say it's done and get no further feedback and make no further changes and never come back to it? Is it something you do two or three times until you feel like you've solved that problem? Or is it something you're doing 15, 20 times over and over again? We see some of those products that are iterating over and over again on the same type of thing because they're tweaking it. They're making fine adjustments to it. I love the ability to do that. I'm jealous that I don't get to do some of those things in my core product. So they're always trying to improve that core usability or core functionality of their applications and their products.
Yeah, and this is where, to me, I start to think about continuous discovery and the idea that, you know, we always talk about continuous delivery and continuous integration, CI/CD and all that type of stuff, but the same goes for continuous learning and continuous exploration and continuous validation and iterations like that. And, you know, a great product designer I worked with, he said this to me once, and he said, you know, like everyone tries to find that magic number of how many people do I need to test with to get, you know, uncover problems? How many, you know, how many iterations do I need to do? How do I just do one design sprint, which is very common, as opposed to like stringing multiple together. And he said, like, you're always like trying to find that magic number is not really the important part. The important part is your iterations and your cycles. So you're better off doing 10 iterations of testing with 8 people than one iteration of 80 people, even if you went that big, right? Which you pretty much never do. But the idea is iterations. It's not about getting it perfect, and you're not going to get a lot of people at the beginning. But you just want enough that you're going to learn something, then you're going to tweak, and then just have enough to learn something else and tweak again. And that's part of going deeper too, and really kind of exploring it. Can you imagine doing 10 iterations on one thing? That'd be amazing, right? And many places do it. I've done it before. Agreed, don't do it as much, and that's where this whole conversation kind of comes from. Do we do it enough? I don't feel like we do. I was having my own reflection during the week. That's why I drew that, had that tweet. But some places do it quite well, and you do see it. Little things constantly tweaking. Even just as simple as a landing page and a sign up screen can be so important. So you're constantly tweaking that.
Yeah. And so let's talk about some reasons, and they're probably pretty common, about why we don't get to do this deep thinking around customers or problems or exploring those customers or problems. Part of me says it's all about priorities and stakeholders, that people come in and say, hey, we need you to do this now. And that's not the core problem that the customer has, but it's something that we can get a deal if you do this thing. There's a one-off request for this VIP client. There was a really good tweet by the Swordly, who was talking about the cost of doing something as a one-off. So I really like that notion of we don't do one-offs. We solve core problems. We don't just do what the stakeholder wants. We don't do what the CEO had a golf game about, with somebody and said, do this thing. We really want to solve those core problems. We don't want to be spread out. We don't want to be shallow of a lot of things. We want to be deep on one or two real core problems.
Yeah, totally. And one of the things that you got me thinking about and this is one of the reasons why we don't do it enough too, is the clarity on strategy and the clarity on direction and where we're playing, how we're going to win, all those types of things. Yeah, that's definitely something that I don't see enough too. And if you're not clear on those things, you almost want to do many things, right? Just start to do everything. Hey, especially in a B2B world, this is so common in a B2B world, of new big client worth lots of money. It's willing to sign the dotted line, but if only we build these features for them and suddenly we do that, that's fine once, and then we do it again and then again and again, and then we end up with this thing that's so bloated that we can't actually iterate on it. We can't improve because it's just weighed down by technical depth and complexity. And then suddenly the clients that we did win are now leaving to go somewhere else because they're like, your system's too hard to use now can't get updates. And then even for a business point of view, it's very costly for you to maintain that and update it and manage it and run it. But the idea of the more clear you are on the direction you want to go to, the value prop you're trying to solve, the problems that you're trying to solve, which is where that all comes from, where you want to play, how you're positioned, your strategy, then you will be able to say no to things and to say, no, we're going to do these few things, but we're going to do them really well. We're going to go deep into those spaces,
right,
as opposed to being broad and shallow. Look at all the features I have, and you're trying to sell, that's your value prop, right? Instead of my value props is I solve problems for you. It's I have all these shiny bells and whistles and buttons and you should buy it because it looks cool, right? And then they might buy it initially, but retention is not going to be there because it's not providing them value. So that's probably one thing. The other thing is definitely distractions. I think we're constantly in this battle of balancing strategy versus, tactics and today's, winning today's battle and then winning the overall war. And again, without a clear sight of our strategy and our vision, it's very easy to get distracted. You can remain more grounded when that's clearer. But even then, you're always putting out fires. You're always trying to chase certain things. And there is only a finite amount of hours in the day. And sometimes you may decide to not iterate on something that extra time or further just because you've got bigger fish to kind of fry. And I think that's okay. But I think we need to be very, careful with those decisions and at least be very deliberate about it and actually make it as a conscious decision and not just chase, be stuck in a firefighting kind of world.
Yeah. there's enough problem with firefighting as it is.
Yes.
One of the things that I've heard, I've had, you know, VPs, directors, you know, bosses, other people, I've had teams tell me this before is, we've solved that problem. You know, we did the thing. We understand that's a core thing. We had stories. We iterated on it. We've solved, quote unquote, that problem. Let's go to the next one. Whereas I might think, well, maybe we've solved it for now, or I don't feel comfortable about how we've solved it. What else could we do? And there's the notion of you solve that problem and move on versus the you've solved that problem. I have to keep these people busy in order to do something. I think some of the best products that I use, and they're very small teams, where some of the enterprise products and teams I've worked with, the people always have to be busy, or the people view them as always having to be busy. So there's always the next thing, the next thing. They can't just iterate on the same thing that they've just done a release for, and you know, we can't try it out anymore. They want to declare it done and move on.
Yeah, I kind of talked a little bit about that before, and I was talking about that busyness and that, you know, we like to see output, and it's and that's definitely a huge piece of the puzzle from a systematic point of view in the organization. Where do they sit on that journey of, or that spectrum of, we want to just keep people busy and just because we're paying them, so they need to be producing some kind of output, as opposed to no, we focus on outcomes, and we're okay that they haven't shipped anything, any new functionality in the last like 3 months because they've been, you know, tweaking and fixing bugs or something like that, right? Like, we're comfortable with that, or even they've just spent the last 6 months understanding the problem space. Maybe not 6 months, but you get my point, like 6 weeks or something, understand the problem space more. We're okay with that because we're focusing on the outcomes that we have. I think the other piece of the puzzle around, you know, we solve that problem, we move on, is measurements. And we talked about that pursuit at the beginning and the T at the end with metrics.
Yeah,
I think that's so crucial. And, you know, I actually, there was one of my tweets the other day actually around having that past column on a board, even on your roadmap, that you measure, right? And if you put things there and things sit there, it acts as a bit of a forcing function to say, hey, we should go back and revisit that. And maybe we have revisited it and we've said, okay, we solved the problem, but we've probably solved it for now. That piece, if it is a important enough problem, let's say a core problem that you're part of your value proposition, then that metric should probably be something that you should always monitor, right? Something you should always have a pulse check on. And we talk about, you know, the North Stars and all those types of things. And that's where those frameworks kind of come in to help. But yeah, especially if it is really core, you should always have a pulse on it. You know, as a product manager, a product owner, you should have some kind of metric. I don't want to use the word dashboard, but you can imagine it, right?
Yeah.
And you are monitoring those things and you're saying, well, what is the, I think about product health, and that's what you're really looking at. How healthy is my product? These are the four core problems, which is our core value proposition. How are they doing?
Yeah.
Are we doing well in them? Are we still doing well in them? Do I need to do something? And if you're monitoring that, then yeah, it's okay that you solved it for now, but things can change quickly, as we know.
Very, very much so. What are some examples, do you think, of products that are out in the public domain, at least, that you use, or anything else that you think do this really well? Any of your favorites or anything that you've seen that exemplify this deep thinking on customer problem behavior?
Yeah, so I think when you ask that question, I become possibly a little bit, I know it's availability bias, but it would be quite some time ago, but a couple of weeks, maybe months ago, Slack did one of their major reskinnings, right? And they actually released a whole blog, whole page that they not only talked about the changes that they made, which, you know, is interesting enough in itself because you use Slack every day, but what I loved about the article, and I love organizations talking about the way they work, was they actually walked through not all of it, but they walked through kind of the pertinent points in the research that they did in order to make the decisions that they had. And they actually showed a few examples of things that they tested that didn't test well, and they decided to go down another path as a result. And I thought that was fantastic that, you know, to not only talk about it, but it actually showed that, hey, we actually did you know, we put a lot of thought into this. We did a lot of rounds of testing. We did, you know, a lot to come up with the, and it, what they did it because they knew it was a major release, it was a major reskin, and they were trying to, you know, really kind of go deeper on those problems and solve them well. So, I mean, that one comes to mind, definitely at the top of my head. Other ones that I just kind of, I think about is, you know, any product that is still very simple, right? They haven't actually changed too much. Yeah, you know, actually one that I use a lot, which is actually probably quite a new product, but Calendly, right? Calendly, for scheduling across time zones. Yeah. Like such a simple product. It's in some regards a little clunky, but it's quite a new product, but it solves a very deep problem, which is this whole idea of scheduling. And even like Google Calendar and stuff, they tell you the time zones, but it still doesn't solve the problem as well as, say, Calendry does, right? Like you still end up going and using them and then ironically paying them for it. That's something I use every day actually. And it's quite impressive, especially because it's quite a new product too on the market. But I think it solves quite a deep problem that everybody else has scratched the surface on, is probably what I'm getting at. Mm-hmm. So like you take Google Calendar as an example, it will tell you the two different time zones. Some other products do even one step better, and they'll, like Slack will give you a warning. They'll say, oh, by the way, this is, you know, 1 a.m. in their time or something like that, which is great. But going even deeper to say, how do we make scheduling across those time zones easier? I think they've done a fantastic job there.
That's a great example. Some of the ones that I think do this well, and again, I don't know. I haven't talked to these people yet. I'd love to. Yep. But Miro, the former real time board. I love how Miro does. You know, they're solving the problem around group communication or group collaboration, I should say. You know, how can we get large groups remotely or even in the same room to collaborate better together? And their boards, their tools, the things they're adding, they're constantly focusing on the collaboration tools that people want or need. And it's like every week there's a new update about, here's this thing we've added that made it cool, right? They finally added the ability for me to auto-align sticky notes. Thank God, right? Sometimes I get anal and I want my sticky notes to be horizontal and vertical. Sometimes I want them to be clumped. But giving me the ability to do that, and they've added more functionality around that, but it's still around that core thing that they're trying, which is group collaboration, and I love that. Discord is something that I think I use a lot when I'm doing my raids, and it's also something that I use a lot for just communication with different groups. Slack, Zoom, WebEx, all these corporate products and all these bigger products, they're slow compared to what Discord can do and how Discord reacts to their customers and their users. They're much faster and much more deeper on those community connections. And how to interface that. You know, they have split rooms. You can do, Zoom just got split rooms a couple of weeks ago, and Discord's had them forever. I really like those two examples. And then I've talked about the movie theater app that I've used. I think it's Fandango, where the movie experience, the problem of I want to go to a movie theater, and granted, we can't do that right now, but when we could, the way to search, find, purchase, and get into my movie. The get into the movie was the thing that blew my mind, because I bought the ticket online on the app. And then, you know, when I walk up to the theater and I open the app to get the ticket, it presents the ticket for me. It knew what I was coming there for. It solved that problem for me. And they kept doing that every couple months, and I'd go to another movie and it would be better. It would be even better than it was the last time. That's that type of iteration that I just love to see when products and companies do that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
That's what we're trying to do. We're trying to explore. We're trying to think deeply about some of these things. You know, I think the first problem is, can we have the time? can we cut out the other BS that we're being asked to do or that's being foisted on us? Can we say no? Can we align it to our vision and strategy? What are some techniques or some of your favorite techniques or methods that you've used when you're going deep on something or want to try to go deep on an idea or a problem that you'd like to use? I use, I like the five whys, or it's an oldie but a goodie. I do like the idea of not saying why five times, because you sound like a petulant child and you'll probably get kicked. And I like David Marquez's version of not asking why, but asking how or what questions. Those are much more powerful questions, and they're, you elicit the same response as why, but you're not just saying why.
Yeah, yeah. David Marquez's questions as well. Yeah, they come to mind as well. Lovely stuff in general. But yeah, the five whys, so monotonous. One of the things that I tend to do a lot too in this space is a lot of kind of tree diagram type mapping mm-hmm. type things. We talked about before the idea of one problem could, you know, there could be multiple problems spanning off that. I really like to visualize things that way, whether it's just my own mind mapping or whether I'm collaboratively doing it with people. Sometimes just, you know, that even if it's a brainstorm and it starts in the middle, we branch out that way and then we might rearrange it as time goes on. But that's a great tool to show, you know, that it branches, right? And there's multiple things. It's not so linear and connected as it may be. Something as well that I've used in the past is like causal loop diagrams. Mm-hmm. That's a whole tool. A little tricky to kind of learn, but once you get a hang of it, it makes a lot of sense. You can even just dumb it down a little bit if you wanted to, and not have all the things in it. That's another great tool. The other one that I sometimes, you know, in this space, and we talked about the time piece of the puzzle, is sometimes it's you know, creating the space, right? And you might start with an initial session. Maybe you did some customer interviews and you did a synthesize, like you did some real-time synthesis. Maybe you had like an hour or so afterwards, or maybe even less, and you just kind of like synthesized it a bit more as a group and kind of discussed through it. Maybe you have the rest of the day free, but maybe you're better off calling it there, going and doing something else, and then coming back tomorrow, right? And this idea of spacing things out, we don't always do. And I think spacing things out can be quite powerful. In my experience, it has been powerful because, you know, you can go home, you can sleep on it, you'll be amazed, you'll probably think of something while you're in the shower, which if you kind of decided to plow through right then and there on that day, you probably wouldn't have got. And everyone's going to have that shower thought. And then we're going to sit down tomorrow morning and we're all going to be like, oh my God, I thought about this and then this. And, you know, I was reflecting on that. And then now you're in a way better place, and just by kind of spacing things out. So yeah, that's definitely a tool that I use a lot.
Yeah, that think time is very important. I've gotten to the point where I, even if it's an important question or decision and I think I know the answer, I'll wait at least minimum of 2 hours, more likely a day, that I'd like to wait before I make a decision or respond or something else. And I agree. Some of the best ideas or the best thinking I do is when I'm walking my dog. It's weird. It's just the mind wanders and it comes back and says, hey, did you think about this? And you go, oh, that's really cool. So I love that. I also use maps. You know, we talked about story maps and value stream maps. Journey maps are great. Experience maps for your customer and how they experience things are great. There's lots of canvases, A3 canvas, problem solving, lean canvases, all different types of things that can help with this. There's really no end to it. But try a few of them. Again, I guess the big thing is just let's find the time. Let's convince people. Maybe that's the wrong word, but let's find a way to make the argument that this is a valuable thing, is to go deeper on these problem solving, these core problems that we need to spend more time on, and we need to spend more effort and more energy on it so that we can make it even better than it is now.
Yeah, they can... convincing, and maybe not that word, but that's always an interesting part. Another part of it for me is just being comfortable with that idea. Like I was talking about before, we walk into a meeting, we converge on something, we walk mm-hmm. out and we praise everybody because it was a 15-minute meeting and it was highly effective. Being that, to me, like it's funny because over the years and doing this and I actually get uncomfortable when we do that now. Like that's a smell to me. It's the opposite. It's a red flag. It's not, it's not a good thing. You know, everyone's patting themselves on the back, but I'm, you know, raising a red flag. So it's that kind of awareness piece as well as also being comfortable with it. Like, mm-hmm. you know, the whole process is often uncomfortable, and we get very, like even people who are uncomfortable with ambiguity get uncomfortable with it because it's long, it's arduous, it's, you know, we don't feel like we're getting anywhere, or, you know, we're spinning our wheels. We don't feel like traction. It feels like we've gone in circles, but that's part of the process, right? That's what we need to do in order to, you know, really kind of explore the problem space and to really understand you know, what's the best solution to kind of go forward with, is we need to go through that process. And any kind of, you know, there's no shortcuts to it is probably what I'm getting at. And
right.
And we're, because we're uncomfortable with it, we want to avoid it. But it, part of the convincing is to also let people know that it's okay and that it's going to be uncomfortable and we've got to go through it and it's for the better. And once you've done it a few times, you'll start to see that, yes, the outcomes were better. Like, I never would have came up with that if we didn't, you know, spend that time. And then you become more, maybe not more comfortable with it, but you become more open to the idea that, hey, yeah, actually we should spend more time thinking about this and we should go in circles a bit more. And, you know, yeah.
Yeah, more experience, more knowledgeable about it's not going to hurt us. It's not going to be that painful. We can do it, and we can have a better experience doing that. So I think that's great. Okay, so again, it's something that I see a lot of people now that I scheduled this episode to talk about, and Anthony and has drawn his drawing. I'm seeing a lot of other people talking about depth and going deep on various things, technical things, marketing things. It's interesting that might be the new buzzword for the back half of 2020 is to go deep on things. But thank you, Ant, for the drawing. Thank you for talking. And now one of the things we do with first-time guests is we play three questions. Are you ready for your three questions?
Yep.
All right. First question is, what are three apps or products that you use in your personal life and tell me why you love them?
So in my personal life, I naturally use Messenger app a lot for group chats. I probably only love it because it's just good for group chats and sharing photos. The other one that I use a lot is Google Photos, actually. The ability to share it with my wife and my partner, and she's French, so I'm Australian, we're in Australia, and she has a lot of family overseas. We also share photo albums with her family. So now that we have a son who's approaching 3 years old, it's a great way to share. So we just, photos upload automatically. I then kind of share certain ones with them, and it's a great way for everyone to be able to see our photos and kind of see our life. We're not really big social media people, so that works really well, and I think it just works better. They just almost have access to our photos of our son, which you know when you have a new kid in these days and age, you're taking a lot of photos, right? So that's another one that I love for that reason. Like, it just really enables them to watch those videos and see those pictures of them growing up, which is fantastic. And especially now when we can't really fly over there, is a huge piece of the puzzle. And then probably the last one is that I use an app called Pocketbook. It's mainly just for tracking like finances and stuff. It integrates with your bank and it just kind of tells you how much you're spending on, say, coffee in the morning and those types of things. But I like it because I think other banking apps are trying to solve that problem space, but nobody has done as good of a job as they have at the moment. So,
That's one of those problems that you can go really deep on because nobody's really solved it. I mean, how many banks are there that have these apps and these online products and they all suck pretty much? They all don't help us do what we really want to do. That's a great example. Okay. Second question. What's the second most amazing thing you've seen a product owner do?
Second most amazing. I think one of the ones that always gets me really kind of warm and fuzzy inside, maybe, or really happy is when they spend more time kind of empowering, right? And they, you know, you get to the stage where they're not the one saying, hey, we should do this. They're saying, well, what do you think, right?
Yeah.
Like, and then the engineer is saying, well, I think we should do this. So that's because, like, the problem, you know, the interviews that we had last week said this, and, you know, we really should be, I think this is the best way to do it. And they kind of say, awesome. Like, let's do it, right? I think that is, one of the main ones for me.
Very cool. And the third question, what product ideas are you most excited about in the future?
Yeah, so there's probably a few spaces that I'm really interested in. One of them is just because of COVID and this whole situation, I'm really interested in Discord and watching where they go and where they play and how much of the market share they potentially steal. That is one piece of the puzzle that I'm really interested in. The other one that I've been interested in for quite some time, which I feel like COVID has accelerated, and you know, it, is the whole stream, like movie streaming space. Mm-hmm. And it's not because like movie streaming is like this big thing. My view is, and we talked about that movie theater app just earlier, was where does movie theater sit in the future? When more and more people have bigger TVs at home, better sound systems, and they can stream movies at home, where do movie cinemas go? Will places start to just offer box office movies straight away, right? And maybe it's not for free. Maybe it's like what Disney had to do with Mulan and they had to charge for it. But, you know, there could be a period of time, because that's what they always do, right? It's charged for a period of time while it's in box office, and then for a period of time thereafter as well when you buy it on, you know, DVD or whatever. And then it goes out to kind of more of these streaming services. And so that's another space that I'm pretty fascinated in. And Mulan's kind of like, I think, accelerated. I wonder if they've always had it as a strategy, and COVID's just kind of made them pull the lever on a little early.
It's interesting to think about that, because it's not a technology problem.
No.
It's how much money does the studios think they can get? You know, they're used to the box office. I mean, that's one of those entrenched ways of working that, you know, so many organizations, so many companies, so many industries go through, and they just completely change. It's about time for the movie industry to completely change how they do things. So yeah, that'll be really curious, because the technology's there and they've already proven it a couple times, but yeah, they either have to break even, or they'll have to find some other way to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. And then the third one would be the kind of neo-banking space. Mm-hmm. We talked about large banks giving quite poor experiences, and that's been notorious. And in Australia, we had the Royal Commission quite recently, so the banking industry's had a shake-up, is a whole interesting one to me. But the more and more we live in this experience economy, the easier it becomes for a player to come on the market. And you've already seen it with like Upbank and all these neobanks that are popping up in Australia to just come in and just take it over. Like Upbank don't offer a lot of functionality. It's like a transaction account and that's about it. And they're adding functionality, they're going deeper in that space, but they're already acquired heaps of customers because it's just such a great experience. The branding's on point, the positioning's good. Mm-hmm. And I wonder how, you know, not just the experience economy, but I guess the kind of ethical economy comes into that puzzle as well, as we become more, you know, sensitive to, you know, ethical behaviors, in especially in banks, but also just in other spaces around like fashion and sustainability and those types of things, right?
Very cool. All right. Thank you, Ant. Those are your three questions. Very good job. And if you have any feedback or questions about product ownership, you can contact the show on Twitter at Delivercast or email us at delivercast@gmail.com. Please do share the show around with friends or coworkers, subscribe, and help us reach more folks. A couple questions. We'll see how many we got time for. The first one is from Bob, who asks, how should design decisions be approached mid-sprint? Says, let's say there's a disagreement with design that happened in the middle of a sprint. Only part of the team was involved during the disagreement. The remaining members were not consulted until later. In a one-on-one situation, should the whole team have been involved the entire time? I feel like we wasted a lot of time building alliances, in quotes, and not actually resolving the issue. Okay. Ant, do you have thoughts on this one before I say anything?
I have thoughts on it. And I guess one of the things I often think about in this is we talk about getting more engineers involved in, say, design and discovery. I think it goes both ways. Designers definitely need to get more involved in the delivery side of the fence, and trying to work out how do we solve the problems. I mean, part of it is to facilitate that, and that's part of it, you know, everyone's kind of role in that, and that's why they should be more involved and get empathy of where they're coming from. But whether the whole team needs to be involved every time, I guess, is probably more of a team decision to work out whether is that how you want to make decisions. I think there's a lot of power in a team deciding. Mm-hmm. It's ironic, but or paradoxical, but deciding on how they make decisions. All right, we're mid sprint design disagreement. How is that reconciled? And if you can agree on that as a team, is that everybody going into a room and we generate consensus, or is it majority rules, or is it, you know what, that the designer has veto there and they can decide. I think there's a lot of power in that, right? And establishing that as a team.
Yeah, it really does depend on how the team has, you know, set themselves up to work, how they've agreed to work. If everybody's mobbing and the designers are in there, I don't see this as a problem. I've also not worked on a group where we mobbed 100% of the time. There were things where we had, you know, we had teams and we might have had two or three stories in progress because there was different pairs or different sets of people working on it. And I always had an argument with a development manager that not everybody needed to know everything. It's nice if it can happen naturally or if it's possible, but sometimes it isn't possible for everybody to know everything because they're off doing their story or they're talking to this customer or they're focused on this piece of work and a decision gets made over here. You know, yes, you'll see it in the retro. You might hear it at stand up, but every minute of the day going through and saying, hey, did you check with so-and-so and get this okayed? I don't think that's a good, again, unless the team's set up to work like that, I don't know if that's a good dynamic. I've never seen it work personally. So, there are design changes in the middle of a sprint, right? There are things that the designer designed, the developer's trying to code, they can't code, they've got us stuck. You know, what do I do? What do I do now? Because I can't finish the story with this design or something happened and what do we do to get it done by the end of the sprint, right? Do we remove something? Do we take something out? Those types of things I would want to talk about during the sprint with the people involved in the story, the designers, the engineers, the testers, myself as a product owner. I would want to talk about those things and then, you know, let's make a decision or let's think about a decision. Let's have a default and then come back to it, like we were saying, in a couple hours or something and see what we think about it then. And the other question was from Katie, who has a product owner who is getting somewhat understandably frustrated with the team. She says the PO wants to release the next product increment to production once the top two user stories in the sprint are done. These are leftovers from the previous two sprints that the team took into the sprint backlog was not able to complete twice. And it seems they won't be able to do it in this sprint either, as there are still bugs associated with these two stories. This is starting to seep into team dynamics as she, the product owner, is getting frustrated with the team when they have been taking into three sprints so far. And even when the stories are the top priority, they are not able to complete it somehow. Okay, I'll go first on this one and I'll get your thoughts, Ant. For me, this is one of those things where how big is that story? What is the scope of the story? Is it too big? Is that why they're not able to finish? Is there a technical problem? Is there a skill problem with this? You know, what are the other problems? Why this thing has not been finished in three sprints now? My gut tells me it's too big. As most stories I see, they're either too big or they're not sliced correctly or small enough to where they could be delivered in a sprint. Or there's something that's stopping the team from delivering it. Very rarely is it actually the team doesn't know how to do it. It's something else that, oh, well, we got to have this approval to do this thing, or we have to go through 16 different gates to get it out to production or something else. There's usually something else other than the team doesn't know how to do this. So I would focus more on the story size. I would focus more on what's stopping the team from doing this. So I would start there. And then if it is something where it's a team skill or issue, then you can address it with, the team, you can address it with managers, you can address it with some other way.
Yeah. I think slicing tends to be one that I see often is how have the stories been sliced. Have they been sliced in a way that they're small enough to be done, but not just that, they're also independent and not highly, connected is always one of them. One of the ones that I thought was kind of interesting in that whole kind of question was the idea of still bugs outstanding and carryover. And, you know, I mean, bugs make me wonder around not necessarily quality, but like, you know, that idea of garbage in, garbage out, you know, how did we define that story? Was the story clear enough to begin with? Did we actually know what we were building? Or was there a huge amount of scope creep and the first sprint just blew up because we weren't really clear on it? So it blew up. And then now we're just building all the stuff that we added in the last sprint and this sprint. And, you know, there's a huge amount of pressure to do so. So we've rushed it and cut a lot of corners. And now we're just cleaning up all the bugs that we've, you know, inevitably introduced by doing so. I mean, it could be many things, but that kind of comes to mind when I kind of hear those words. But yeah, definitely. I think like even it's, and this comes back to the kind of what we've been talking about, the depth of the problem space and really exploring it. It's very easy for us to say, no, you know what? I'm frustrated. We need to release as quickly as possible. So we just keep plowing through. Or we can pull the brakes and say, hey, you know, we've invested 4 weeks, 4 to 6 weeks on this so far. Let's actually talk about, you know, maybe it's a retro about specifically those two stories. What's going on? Not to point fingers or anything, but to say, well, is there something we're missing? Is there something really deep here that we're not addressing, and that's why it's dragging on? And if we don't address it, we won't get done this sprint either, and it won't get done next sprint, and it'll turn into a 12-week thing, and we'll finally kind of somewhat duct tape it all together to ship it.
Now, I like that idea of going back and thinking, okay, are we really solving the right problem? Is this really the thing that we should be doing? Because obviously there's an issue with it somehow. What did we not think about when we did this? Or what didn't we not think enough about when we did this? I like that thought. That's definitely something I didn't consider. Very cool. All right, Ant Murphy. You can find him on Twitter at @Ant_Murphy and on Medium at Ant Murphy. Any other places or things you want to let folks know about?
You can always find me on LinkedIn. I tend to sporadically post things between Medium, Twitter, and LinkedIn. People tend to find me on that too. It's a good avenue to reach out, messaging wise. But yeah, all good, man. Thank you for having me, and thanks for the discussion. Always just enjoy talking with like-minded folks about interesting topics. So yeah, it's good, man. And we've talked on Twitter so much too, so it's awesome. Yeah.
Very cool. All right. Thank you, Ant. And please go follow Ant, because he's going to draw something within the next week or so. I just know it. And it'll be a wonderful thing that will be shared all over the place. So make sure you go and follow. And don't forget that if you would like any one-to-one coaching, product consulting, or organizational agility help, I do offer that over at seektaiju.com. All the opinions expressed here are mine. You'll find more of them at Corey Bryan on Twitter. That is episode 115 delivered. Go out and own the outcome.
This show is part of the Agile Podcast Network. For more shows and information, visit agilepodcastnetwork.com.